Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Hi there, folks, and welcome to another edition of Ancient Future Faith. My name is Chris Alford. I'm the pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community right here in Sacramento, and the host of this program, where on Saturdays, we're sketching out a pretty big picture and trying to answer a pretty big question. That is, what in the world is ancient future Christian faith? By the way, we'd love to have you come worship with us at Epiclesis. You can find more information about Epiclesis, the church, on the web at epiclesis.org. You spell that EPICLESIS.org. Today in the studio helping me to answer that question is one of our very own Epiclesis elders. She's also the director of our worship and liturgy. Her name is Dr. Ellen Kohler. Hi, Ellen. Welcome.
Hi, Chris. Thanks. It's good to be here.
You know, one of the questions that I get often about Epiclesis is, okay, so what's the music like or what's the worship like? That seems to be one of the things that people most want to talk about. So I thought today we would talk a little bit about worship, about liturgy, what in the world liturgy is, and how... Well, a description of our service probably defies description. It's unlike a church service that perhaps many people have gone to. We're evangelical, but we're also a lot of other things as well. So shall we talk a little bit about worship and liturgy today?
I think that'd be great.
Now, Ellen, your responsibility at Epiclesis is to design our liturgy. You're also a wonderful pianist and composer. So this is a task that you're thinking about and working on all week long, right? It's not just a Sunday thing for you.
No, it's not just a Sunday thing. It goes through the entire week, and it extends into our discipleship, into our small groups, into our interactions with one another. Worship is basically everything that we do.
Yeah, well, I hope that's something we can touch on, because that's a little bit of an interesting notion, perhaps to some evangelicals, to think that worship is not just a Sunday thing, but it touches every aspect of the body of Christ. It touches on everything we do as a church. You said discipleship, for example, and all of those things are tied together.
That's right. And one of the things that we like to use as a working definition at Epiclesis for worship comes from the writings of Robert Weber.
Okay, yeah.
Right. He says that worship tells, sings, prays, and enacts the whole story of God.
So let me get that again. It tells and sings and prays and enacts the whole story of God. That's a pretty tall order, isn't it?
You know, we can't tell the entire story of God in all of its aspects in every one of our services. Mm-hmm. But when we meet together, our services are to reflect and illuminate the whole story of God, from creation through incarnation, through recreation, the whole big story of God.
So that means, I guess, that when you're putting together a Sunday morning worship experience, you're drawing upon all of the scriptures for the day and thinking about the way to musically enhance them, thinking about a way to meaningfully involve the congregation. And we really try to do that at Epiclesis. I hope we can talk about that here in a minute. But as you're thinking about these things, you're thinking about how you want to tell God's story in worship. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And I think it's interesting when we think about definitions of worship. For a lot of people, worship is the song part of the service. It's the mm-hmm. sung part of the service.
Right. And
so, I mean, evangelical churches call their meetings worship services, but a lot of us tend to think of the worship as being what we sing.
Right.
And then there's the teaching part, and there's the offering part, and the announcement part. And so,
or sometimes people think of the worship service, at least I know some pastors who are wired this way, think of the worship service as just the teaching. I remember one time I was leading a service of worship, and the pastor got up for his preaching time and said, "Well, I tell you what, if I didn't know any better, I'd say we've worshiped in here already today." And I said, "Well, yeah, that was the point."
Yeah, but the interesting thing about worship is that it really does draw on all the parts of who we are. If I could just quote Weber one more time,
yeah.
Well, at least for now anyway, if we can visualize an hourglass, if we visualize an hourglass, it's set on its side.
Okay.
And at the very center of that, the waist of the hourglass, is worship. So he describes it this way. On the left, everything that we do in our lives, our work and leisure, everything moves toward the center, towards worship. And on the right, everything that one does in life, work and leisure, is empowered by our worship. So we come together to see and to enact and to be empowered by the whole story of God as we go back out into the world to love and serve the Lord.
Oh, so you're saying then the worship is the skinny part of the hourglass, again, set on its side.
Right.
So that it's a kind of a narrowing of our focus.
Mm-hmm.
We meet with and have an encounter with the risen Christ in worship, and then we're propelled forth to go into the world, and we're impacted by what we did in worship.
Right.
Mm.
One of my favorite descriptions in Scripture for worship is, well, I have a lot of them. I mean, I love the one from Psalm 27 that says, "This one thing I've asked of the Lord, that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to meditate in his temple." And there you've got meditation and contemplation. You've got head and heart there.
Mm-hmm.
But really one of my favorites, and I think that a lot of people probably don't think of this one as necessarily depicting worship, comes from John 9. Mm. It's the story of the man born blind.
Okay.
Jesus had heard that the Pharisees had excommunicated this poor man, and he finds him and he says, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And the man answers and says, "Who is he that I might believe in him?" And Jesus tells him, "You've seen him, you're talking with him, it's me." And then the man replies, "Lord, I believe." And then John says an interesting thing, "And he worshiped him."
Hmm.
So I think it's interesting that the whole story is there. The man was born blind. The fallen earthly order had dealt a pretty heavy blow to him.
Yes, because of the fall of the creation.
Right. And okay. He has an encounter with God incarnate.
Who is also the creator.
Indeed. He's enacted the story, his salvation. Jesus has told him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. Can we say that that's a baptism?
Sure.
In a certain
sense?
Think,
yes, that's a picture of baptism.
Right. And the man, he's empowered to give witness to what he's experienced and to what he's believed. But I love that in the center of that. He believed, he says, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. So he's seen the whole story.
And so that is, in essence, what you're trying to tease out and highlight each time you design a service of worship at Epiclesis.
Yeah.
How can the scriptures appointed for the day, how can the music that we put together, how can the participation of the congregation come together in such a way that we've got God's big story in every single worship service?
That's right. So we do that through the liturgy.
Okay, hold on. Let's talk about liturgy just a second, because in some corners, liturgy is a dirty word. It's a word that maybe people don't understand, or they assume that liturgy necessarily means, what, stuffy, I don't know, rigid.
Right, associated with very highly formalistic churches,
right.
Not necessarily equated with traditional denominational churches, but for a lot of people, when we think of liturgical churches, the liturgical churches are the ones that have a very, very formal structure. The officiant does things for the people, and the people watch. They don't participate.
Okay, but liturgy doesn't really mean that at all, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Well, give us the definition of liturgy. What does liturgy mean?
Well, simply put to me, liturgy structures the narrative, right? It structures the story. In our context, because we use the Revised Common Lectionary, liturgy brings together these texts in telling and singing and praying and enacting the whole of God's story. So it really doesn't have a whole lot to do with style. One definition says that liturgy is a collection of responsive prayers and readings that help the congregation to structure and to flow through their worship.
Okay, so it sounds like you're using the term just by way of describing the structure.
Right.
It's the skeleton that we hang the elements of worship on. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So therefore, every church has a liturgy, right? I mean, every church has some sort of structure.
Right. I mean, we can say every church does have a liturgy, even if they don't think of themselves as being liturgical churches. I mean, you can go into a very loosely formed service, and you can still see something like, well, here's an example. We have one song, and then we say hello, and we have two or three more songs, and then we have the announcements, and then we have the offering, and then we have the teaching, and then we have our responsive time, and then another song, and we go.
And that's liturgy.
Right, that's a liturgy.
Yeah. Well, I think it's always good to point out that the word liturgy comes from a Greek word that simply means the work of the people. And by the way, I think that has incredible implications for us as church to remember that worship is work of the people, not just a few, not just one person speaking, not just one person involved in some sort of way, but rather all of us together doing worship together, the work of all the people.
That's right. It's not just one person doing something and the rest of us watching, Or here's another example, one person leading songs and maybe the worship team and or the choir, but not the congregation necessarily participating right. in all of the singing. I think we've seen that more times than we'd like to.
You know, one thing that strikes me about some forms of worship that at least purport to be more, well, I don't know, relevant or contemporary or exciting or attractive, is that worship in those settings is not necessarily more participative. In fact, many is the time that I've been in a worship service where the music is very high energy and there's lots of, I don't know, lights and activity, say, on the platform, the stage, but the congregation itself is fairly passive. They might be standing, but many people don't sing. They kind of just stand there looking at some sort of performance. So I think it's wrong to assume that a certain style of music or church service is going to attract and engage a certain kind of a person. Let's remember that liturgy is supposed to involve all of us. It's the work of the people. So you were saying a minute ago that liturgy is the structure that we hang worship on, but it's really more than that too. Don't you think that liturgy has a kind of a formative element to it?
I absolutely think liturgy has a formative element to it.
How do you mean?
I've been reading a lot of things lately about what folks are thinking about liturgy. Here are a couple of interesting descriptions I've read recently.
Okay.
One refers to liturgy as inherited traditions, things that give us our sense of belonging. I think that's one way that we could interpret that. Another one I thought was quite interesting is liturgy is described as patterns to hold our desires or our longings. Or here's another one. Liturgies are stories we tell to ourselves. Right. So story is really important. There's been a lot of work in Christian circles and theology, certainly on the importance of story. But in psychology and in sociology, the way that we understand who we are as human beings depends a lot on the way we see ourselves fitting into narratives. Some people are saying that there are liturgies everywhere, right? Sports. There are sports liturgies. We know how to behave when we go to a sporting event. Or there are consumerist liturgies, like malls hold certain longings and desires. We go there and, you know, they hold stories that we tell ourselves about what will make us happy. Or entertainment liturgies. And so there's something really intrinsically educational or formative in these stories. They're like scripts that we follow. We enact them, we live them out, and they become a part of who we are.
And they shape how we behave.
They shape how we behave, and they shape what we believe and how we encounter and involve ourselves with others in community.
So it sounds like that when you talk about liturgy, you must necessarily therefore talk about story.
Yes, indeed. Back to one other saying that Robert Weber has. Well, one of his books is Who Gets to Narrate the World?
Sorry, say that one again.
Who Gets to Narrate the World?
Okay.
Who Gets to Narrate the World? And his answer there is that we do, or at least we're supposed to, and that in times past, the church, in fact, did that. And one of the main reasons why we have a responsibility to narrate the world around us is because we know the end. Right? We know the big story. We know how the story ends. In so much of our contemporary culture, there's really no hope. Right. This is really important because in our culture, there are so many competing narratives. Right?
So many competing stories.
So many stories and narratives of who we are and how we fit with one another and what the goal of that is. They're not only in competing religions, the stories of narratives of different religious beliefs and traditions, but other narratives everywhere. There are political ones and philosophical ones and business ones and technological ones and media narratives. They are all competing for our loyalties, for our beliefs, for our adherence, and for our votes in some ways, if we could put it that way. And then there's another conflict in our cultural atmosphere that comes out of the postmodern period that we've been in for the past few decades. And that is that there is no truth. Right? Meta-narratives are the accepted, like, large stories, no longer legitimate sources of truth for us. They're only truth claims, and that there are really no stable meanings. So that's really a hopeless way of looking at life.
Oh, gosh, there's a lot to unpack there. Let's hold on there a minute and then unpack that a little more. First, let me say that you're listening to a radio broadcast we're calling Ancient Future Faith. I'm the host, Chris Alford, the pastor of Epiclesis, an Ancient Future Faith community here in Sacramento. Today, my guest is Dr. Ellen Kohler. She's one of our elders at Epiclesis and also the pianist, composer, worship designer, worship architect, and liturgist for our church. And we've been talking today about liturgy. What in the world is liturgy? And isn't that just something for high churches? No, we've been talking about how liturgy is the framework that we hang the elements of worship on. So in that respect, every church is liturgical. That the classic definition of liturgy is the work of the people. So we need to be reminded that worship is supposed to be participative, that involves all of the people in worship. We've also been talking about this interesting business about narratives and stories, and how, at least at Epiclesis, we try to tell the big story of God each time we gather. But right there before the break, Ellen, you were talking about how our world presents us with so many different competing stories, and not just religious ones. Recap that again, would you? You were saying that there are political narratives, there are sociological narratives. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this idea you said where they're kind of competing with each other and vying for our loyalties. Tell us a little more about those stories, and what in the world does that have to do with worship?
Well, just to take one of those examples, the political narrative, right? If we can just have in our country the ideal political structure so that...
Or leader,
so that everyone will feel like they have a place that they belong and that there is a future and that there is a hope and an end point that is positive, then we will all be happy.
Okay, so you're saying in this particular case of the political narrative, if we're not careful, we can buy into the idea of the political story, that is, the political narrative that says, if we just get the right structure or people involved, then the end point will be positive and we'll all be happy.
That's right, but the narratives are competing. There's no stable structure. There's no stable story. It changes from time to time.
Oh, and I just thought of another one. There's a story out there, there's a narrative out there in our culture that if you have this or that thing, the materialistic nature of our culture, if we buy this particular product, or if we read this particular book, or if we embark on this particular self-help series or healthy eating or whatever, then there is an endpoint, and the endpoint is that we will be happy and fulfilled and whatnot. So is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
It is. Another part of that is that because there's not really any stable meaning, no stable truth, we get to be our own authors. We get to be the authors of our own story, right? One particularly prevalent notion of that in philosophical circles, at least, and these always have their means of finding their way into the church, is that we can be the strong poets of our own life. Right? A pragmatist author in the late 1980s, Richard Rorty, not Christian by any means, but he made this interesting observation. He said, "The novel, the movie, and the TV program have gradually but steadily replaced the sermon and the treatise as the principal vehicles of moral change and progress." He's saying that in the late 1980s.
Wow.
If that was true then, it's so much more true and prevalent now because of our technological developments. I was going to say advances, but I don't think that's exactly what I meant.
Not necessarily, no.
So that means that outside of God's story, there really isn't a preordained narrative, no preordained plot, no converging point of redemption, no recreation, no real community. The closest that we can really hope in this kind of a narrative is that we can have solidarity with one another. We can feel sympathy with one another, but it's not really redemptive.
Now, as you were talking, it strikes me that all of these competing narratives that the world offers or invites us into, all of these competing liturgies, as it were, of the world, are just not very satisfying because they compete with one another. And something else occurs to me, Ellen. We really ought to be making worship look like the opposite place, the opposite story,
right,
to where everybody has just spent the previous week, yes?
Right. If our worship is driven by the culture, then we come in and we're just remaking our relationship with God in the image of the culture around us rather than our understanding of God having drawn us into his story and our place in it, compelling us out into the world to love and serve him and understanding what our place is in his story.
And we may be telling our own story. We may be writing our own poem. We may be singing our own praises, to paraphrase what the author you quoted just a minute ago said.
Right. And we long for story.
Yeah.
We long to know what our place is in the life that we're living. And as human beings, there's another scripture that talks about God having put eternity into our hearts.
Mm.
there's something within us that longs to find that. It's a similar thing to what St. Augustine says when he says, we have a longing in our souls. We are restless until we find our rest in God. And so what we want to do with worship and liturgy in ancient future settings, and especially at Epiclesis, is to show what this big story is of God and how he has called us to be in it. We haven't invited him to be part of our story. He has invited us to be a part of his story because he loves us. And he has offered us redemption, and that is better news and a better happy ending than any other narrative can possibly offer.
That's really well said. And so, in other words, if we let God's story, if we allow God's story to narrate the world, to narrate our world, then it offers an endpoint that we can really get excited about, and that's what draws us together.
That's true. That's the reason why I said earlier that this understanding of worship and what God's story is and how we fit into it necessarily flows into our discipleship, into our small groups, into our community, into our evangelism, into our missions, into everything that we do. Remember I said earlier, I mentioned the metaphor of worship as an hourglass where we bring all of our hopes, we bring all of our experiences in our life into our community setting together when we come to worship God. And then we understand what our place in his story is, and we can go back out with all of those parts of us strengthened and a deeper understanding of who we are. Not only who we are, but who God is, which is ever so much more important.
Yeah, if indeed worship tells and sings and prays and enacts the whole story of God, as you said at the beginning of the broadcast, then therefore that narration doesn't stop when we leave the worship experience, but continues to impact the way we live through the week.
It does indeed. And then we take it out and we talk to each other about it, and we share and we grow.
Okay, so worship tells the whole story of God. It brings together heart and mind. Would you also say that it's God-directed? I mean, it's not telling our story, right?
It's not telling our... It's not focused on the self. It's not about self-help. It's not me-directed. It's not, as I was saying earlier, it's not understanding God as being pulled into my story, but it's understanding me being called into his story and partnering with him.
So it's not about us.
Right, it's not about my felt needs. It's about God knowing my real needs.
That really needs to be trumpeted, especially today, I think. And then another key point and a final point about worship is that after we tell God's story, it doesn't end there. We're sent out in the world, better equipped to love and serve the Lord.
And that's the whole essence of our being together as a community, right? Paul tells us that we come together so that we can be equipped to go out and be the church. That our worship is for the equipping of the saints. He says that in Ephesians 4. And so we come together and our worship sends us out so that we can really be the church, or we can be Christ in the world.
That's beautifully said. Ellen Kohler, thank you so much for joining me today on Ancient Future Faith. I'm grateful. Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about something I love so much.
And folks, if you'd like to see how all this works, we'd love to have you come worship with us at Epiclesis. You can find more on the web at epiclesis.org. That's epiclesis.org. Well, folks, until we gather for another edition of Ancient Future Faith, I want you to really think about this. The road to our evangelical future surely does run through our ancient Christian past. The Lord be with you.
Thank you for joining us for another look at Ancient Future Faith. There is a refreshing wind of renewal blowing through the evangelical church as more and more worshipers turn for inspiration to the rich language and pattern of the ancient church, and they're rediscovering classic Christianity and learning to draw strength from a deep well of time-tested truth and tradition. Want to experience Ancient Future Faith for yourself? Join us for worship at Epiclesis in Sacramento on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. in the chapel at 4600 Winding Way. You can contact us by calling 916-572-9113 or online at epiclesis.org. That's 916-572-9113 or on the web at epiclesis.org.
Hi there, folks. Pastor Chris here with a little note to say that we're right in the middle of one of the best times of the whole Christian year. the celebration of Easter. In the ancient church, Easter was a season of rejoicing, not just a day, and the Easter season is a great opportunity to see what ancient future Christian worship at Epiclesis looks like. Find more information on the web at epiclesis.org. That's EPICLESIS.org. The Lord be with you, and see you next Saturday at 1 p.m. for another edition of Ancient Future Faith.